Hello and welcome to Cruising Through History. My name is Xander and I'm sitting down with Scott Cruz. Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, today, Xander, we have something special.
Oh, what's up?
We have another person with us on the road to history, or cruising through history, if you will. It's Elliot Walcroft. They're a teen librarian from Kenosha Public Library. And Elliot, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I'm very excited. We're going to talk about, we're going to throw back to China in the 1960s, to the Great Famine in China.
Ooh.
Which is, lasted from 1958 to 1962. It's pretty cool.
So what exactly is the Great Famine? Because, I mean,
yeah.
I've heard of potato famine.
Sure.
But what is the China Great Famine?
That's... Yeah, so the Great Famine... generally, we track it as starting about 10 years after the establishment of the People's Republic of China, about 1958. Some scholars say 59. It kind of muddles in the water. But generally, it's tracked to Mao's Great Leap Forward initiative, which, you know, Mao Zedong was the head of the People's Republic of China after the Cultural Revolution there. And his Great Leap Forward was a series of social and economic policies trying to launch China into, you know, being more modern and being a more industrial nation as opposed to, like, agricultural.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these policies were focused on bringing in things like irrigation and new agricultural techniques that would help food production and all these things. Sounds counterintuitive to a famine, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of the irony, is that this was intended to make food production better and help things in China, help modernize them and throw them into the future, so to speak. But instead, the ineffectual application of those policies and the failure of the state to acknowledge the famine led to it getting worse, which is really intriguing, I think.
Yeah, quite similar to... I was thinking about this when we were talking about this subject. It's similar to what happened in what was the Soviet Union in Ukraine.
Sure.
That was more appropriation, though. This was more centrally planned, not well planned.
Not well planned, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I think that a lot of what scholars generally say is that the cause of the famine was the Great Leap Forward, and that's a little bit muddied, but... generally speaking, it's a result of that,
right?
You know, between inefficient like food distribution, you know, inefficient agricultural methods, switching millions of farmers from farming to steel and that sort of production, like iron and steel production. Yeah. So instead of them farming and making food like they originally were, they suddenly were working on steel and iron production, and so you suddenly had a huge lapse of farmers.
So it's not like they found better methods of farming. They just shifted people to completely different fields, and then they didn't adjust for that whatsoever.
Yeah, pretty much. And there was also an issue with, you know, normally in, like, agricultural and agrarian nations, you see there's seasons for farming, you know, it's... you've got a busy season and you've got an off season. So mm-hmm. you've got the busy season where you're planting. Then it's a little bit calmer in spring while you're, you know, tending to your crops. And then really busy in summer when you've got a harvest. And then it kind of falls apart until it's time to plant again, right?
Mm-hmm.
But instead of letting people have that rest period, the Great Leap Forward essentially sent things into, like, okay, instead of doing that, you're going to go and build, you know, a bunch of new things for, like, irrigation. You're going to dig a bunch of new ditches and stuff, but they weren't adequately feeding people for that. So you're requiring increased manual labor, but not providing nutrition to balance that. So you essentially fall into this, like, super overworking your people and starving them at the same time.
Right. And they also had, you see these pictures. I saw these pictures online of these backyard furnaces that they would put on the communes. And they were basically just chucking all kinds of stuff in there to create steel. But what it really ended up doing was, creating this pig iron. It wasn't very sturdy.
Yes.
Because, of course, it was just being made in these backyard furnaces.
Yeah, it was pretty much, you give me every piece of metal you have. You know, your woks, your tools, your hose, everything.
They were stripping buildings and throwing things in
there. Yeah. And so it just kind of, you know, it was well-intentioned, but ultimately caused way more harm than good. And it's kind of why the famine ends up being widely regarded in a lot of, you know, by a lot of historians as being like the deadliest famine in human history, and also one of the greatest man-made disasters in human history.
Yeah, a lot of the famines that I think of, you know, come from a disease in the crops, wars happened, something was salted in there, and it was, or there is maybe someone, you know, forgot something, some locust happened, but this seems very much made to happen and almost made to fail.
Yes, there's some folks who try to say that it's weather related, because I know that in 1958 there was a big regional flood of the Yellow River in Henan province, but that basically, that flood was not significant if you compare it to other floods in similar times. It's the same thing with, there were several droughts, but the droughts in like 1958, 1960, they were not significant compared to other droughts that happened before and after. So realistically, none of that by itself would have caused the famine. It's because then they said, oh, there was a huge, you know, flood of the river, so we're going to transition 2 million farmers to go to these provinces and take them away from the fields and serve as like rescuers and also try to rebuild the banks and all these things. And it's like, oh, well, there's a problem if you take 2 million of your farm laborers and throw them in another area. Suddenly they're not creating the food that you needed them to create.
Yeah, there's no replacement. Like, they didn't, my thought would be, if you're going to move your farmers to industry, is that, you know, you could compensate trade-wise.
Right.
But was there any thoughts of that?
That did not happen, because at the time, China was still very self-isolating. Mm-hmm. They weren't in communication with a lot of other nations, at least properly and trade-wise. So got to think about, like, during this time, anti-communist ideologies were really, really going crazy in the, you know, early 60s. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of countries, I should say, were hesitant to interact, especially with the PRC being so new. Yes. So,
and it's interesting that you mentioned that point, because at this time, China was new on the scene as a communist country. Of course, they weren't always friendly with the Soviet Union.
No.
Mm-hmm. There was a clash there. And of course, after World War II, you had many of these decolonization movements, independence movements going on in the Third World. And so I think they're both vying to say, hey, look, this system produces. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Soviets always said that too, especially when they launched Sputnik, and it was in 57, and it was around this time when the Great Leap Forward started, 58. So that's an interesting context.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because I think that a lot of this too, you know, they're like, oh, we can produce all this stuff if we follow our commune model. But one of the big problems was over-reporting the amount of grain that they were producing. They were lying, you know. There were a lot of party cadres who were lying to their superiors because they didn't want it to seem like the Great Leap Forward was failing.
Right.
That was actually a lot of why the state refused to acknowledge that there was a famine, because it was seen that it would be implied if they acknowledged the famine or put resources to alleviating it, that that was saying that Mao Zedong was wrong and that the Great Leap Forward was a failure. And they did not want the state to seem like it was failing, especially being so new.
But I imagine the people were not a fan of not acknowledging that they're starving.
Yes and no. It's really complicated, because if you look at a lot of, obviously a lot of the peasants were not necessarily literate, and so we don't necessarily have great records from the time, but the records that we do have, there's actually not a lot of bad sentiment towards the state.
Huh.
Because it was pretty much drilled into everyone, you know. Mm-hmm. The state's important. This is important. Communes and communism are the biggest, most important thing right now. And so a lot of them didn't actually necessarily personally blame the state failures, but went to more individual sort of blame.
Interesting.
But that's not necessarily, like, accurate in a historical context.
And I was struck by reading about this, the variations in each region. Local cadres would sort of, some were really tough on people, and others were like, well, we see what's happening here, so we're just going to kind of hang off, and hopefully no one will notice what's going on here.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, the biggest thing, and most of what my research was how different provinces and different, you know, levels of society reacted and how right. they managed to survive or not, considering there were between 15 and 55 million deaths.
Yeah, that's the number but I saw, too.
The thing is that's a really hard number to glean because right. there are some scholars who are saying, like, oh, you know, the PRC was trying to bring that number down because they didn't want to seem like they failed. But then there's other folks who will try and say that, like, oh, but scholars who are anti-communist are inflating that number.
Right.
So you end up with this weird, muddy 40 million death difference.
Yeah, yeah, that's not estimate. It's not like, you know, forgetting you had to have four quarters instead of three. No. That's a 40 million
it's
people.
40 million people.
And because of the political aspect of this,
it's
no
so
everyone argues the number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they say, well, if it's too high, you're you know, you're against, you're anti-communist, you're right. against the regime. If it's too low, then the other one, so you're sort of stuck.
Yeah, there's no good way to estimate it because, you know, at the same time, records from the time are not super clear. Deliberately, there were a lot of places that weren't actually reporting deaths accurately because they didn't want to seem like they were implying failure.
Right.
Which is really intriguing, but I mean, history is intriguing.
So I know you mentioned differences in different area, like different provinces yeah. and areas. I guess, could you continue on that? What were some yeah. differences?
So in Henan province, for example, and Henan is close to Beijing.
Okay.
So you can imagine they're under a lot of scrutiny. And in Henan province, a lot of their method, the peasant method of survival was, they essentially call it qiqing, which is the consumption of like unripe food or
okay.
like green crops. So, you know, you might be eating your corn before it has actually matured, but you have to eat something.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that was their primary method of survival. There are also places that, you know, they ate soil. They had efforts that were like pretending to work, but not actually working because, you know, then you weren't expending energy.
Mm-hmm.
Dicotter actually argues, Frank Dicotter, he's a big scholar in all of this. He argues that this is more common in places like Henan because of the types of crops they were growing there. So because they were growing things like wheat and corn, it was easier to sneak into the fields and, you know,
right.
steal some food and eat that versus like in Sichuan province, they were mostly rice farmers, and it's a lot harder to sneak into a rice paddy versus a field of corn, right?
Right.
So you essentially see some different methods based on not only the crops that are available, but also proximity to Beijing and the capital and how many, you know, the party influence in those areas. So in places that are further away, they likely will have less party influence and oversight, but they're also going to have fewer resources,
mm-hmm.
which makes things messy. I would say that in the further out that you get from the party center, you're probably looking for things like eating seeds, like dry seeds before they've been planted, or right. stealing food from granaries. There's also some similar methods to the Qiqing method that were like eating like wild herbs or stripping bark from trees,
right.
Or eating like banana saplings, and basically trying to just pilfer wild food. But the problem with that method is that it's less quote unquote profitable because you're not getting as good nutrition. So it's less profitable to your body, so you have to scrounge up more in order to have the same nutrition as the unripe crops version.
So this might be like wildly different as we're talking about what people are eating, but does this have an effect on Chinese cuisine? Like what people have developed?
That's a good question. And I don't know for sure, but Chinese cuisine does tend to be very vegetable heavy. So I would not be surprised if knowing that, you know, a history of having to rely on crops because, you know, you've already burned through all your livestock, you know, trying to survive a famine because you can't feed your livestock and mm-hmm. yourself,
right.
That then you might end up relying more on those sorts of things and like foods that are quicker to grow, like bamboo shoots and things.
Certainly
an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking, it's like I would imagine if there was that long of a period of time where how people ate had to shift. Mm-hmm. The people have made a lot of effort in making food taste good.
Yeah.
And so when I hear, you know, just eating seeds or unripe things, I think of ways to make that palatable for the rant person. So I figured I'd ask.
It's interesting, but you also have to think about how in a time of a famine like that, things that are considered luxury goods are things like seasonings that are going to make that food more palatable.
True.
So, you know, salt would be a luxury good. You're not likely to be able to salt your food because nobody can get it. Mm-hmm. We also, there ends up being some interesting discourse about violence on the act of peasants in terms of getting food, you know, but violence would generally be a very last resort, especially post-revolution. Everyone's pretty, you know, shaken up and on their toes, so you don't necessarily want to go attacking, you know, your local party cadres because you don't want to be, you know, killed off sooner than you want to be.
And Frank Dekatter, who you mentioned before, he also talks in his book about these canteens that they had. These were communes. They were like communal kitchen kind of things where they would give out food, and he said, well, it depended who had the ladle.
Yes.
I mean, if they didn't like you or something, they wouldn't give you food.
Yes, exactly. There's actually a lot of evidence that some cadres were basically, they would sit there and use their influence to overtake the food. You know, oh, my political opponent wants food, I'm going to withhold his ladle of rice. Or I really don't like, you know, Mr. Huh down the street. I'm going to just not give his family food because I don't like him and he slighted me one time 10 years ago. And it ends up being just a huge abuse of power, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
And there were other things like in Anhui province. I read about this. The local cadre there is very much a follower of Mao, very rigid. And of course, when they started noticing things were going wrong, the person who made the complaint was labeled a rightist.
Yes.
So you had this anti-rightist campaign going on. Mm-hmm. So of course, no one talked after that. But the problem was, when the cadre discovered how bad the problem was, he couldn't, without looking like a massive hypocrite, report it, so no one reported it.
Yeah, that ends up being a huge theme, is that you are over-reporting your crop yields and then not reporting that there's any issues, because if you did, you are essentially saying, oh, well, the PRC and everyone are failing.
So, Scott, Elliot, you both have extensive notes. I'm sitting here with no notes. And this is like absolutely baffling to me that everyone is so afraid to report that a problem was happening. It's not like a small problem. This is a life or death problem. So did anyone actually go through and report? Were they punished for that?
So somewhat, yes. There is actually I remember there was a missive from Mao at one point where he notes that, you know, I can see that this is happening, but you don't necessarily want to say that we're wrong. And what he ends up saying, I have a note on it somewhere, was that, his missive essentially talks about how the lack of agricultural production, the failure of party members to fix it, was a serious offense, and basically said that they needed to be in control of their party, in control of the people, and needed to be strong and quote-unquote ruthless in handling this.
So there is no acknowledge, like, there's so much ego, kind of, here, because that's, there's... And I don't think we've really talked about leadership on the podcast, but
that's true.
I mean,
at some point you acknowledge your mistakes.
Yeah,
but or do something to fix it.
But you don't want to be the person who's criticizing Chairman Mao. So,
but this is, what if you're wouldn't Mao also think of that?
It's interesting because I think if you talked to Mao, you know, 10 years prior, right when they're riding the high of, you know, managing to overthrow the state, he was more willing in those early years to be more personable, I think, and more in discussion. But then I think that similarly, a lot of, you know, dictators and things end up falling into this, where their rise, they're very in communication with their people, and then once they are, you know, in that highest seat of power, they no longer want to be criticized.
Right, and a good example of that is Joseph Stalin.
Yes.
I mean, he was warned repeatedly that the Germans were going to invade the USSR in 1941, and he just kept saying, nope, it's all imperialist lies or whatever, and it's a plant, and
right.
Even his own spies that were working for him were telling him.
Right.
And he was basically saying, this is fake news, this is false information.
So everyone really needed a George Washington to their Hamilton, because winning was easy, but governing is a lot harder.
And of course, you know, if you're a local cadre, you're trying to impress those above you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to rise in your political status. So you're sitting there and you're like, I'm on this lowest tier, but if I can falsify my records to say that we have way more grain than everyone else, then maybe I'll be promoted and move up through the ranks, and then I'll be able to survive better, and my family will be able to survive.
Right.
It falls into a lot of selfishness as well.
Yeah, it's there. I mean, we typically think of communism as something that is a group coming together community. And sharing and talking and working
yes.
together right. for the whole wide community good, but
it ended up being exactly the opposite in this case. It ended up being a lot of, you know, personal hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some, if I'm wrong, please correct me. I think there were some attempts to look into, I mean, because there was this sort mm-hmm. of free speech campaign or mm-hmm. something Mao called it. But then I thought, what a great way to flush people
yep.
out.
That's exactly kind of where it falls.
So someone's going to stand up and say, know, like, ah, blah, blah, and then you're going to say, that person.
It's like, ah, yes, there's the person that we need to strategically silence.
Right.
It also ends up being really interesting in that a lot of documents, they don't label a lot of things like food theft and stuff like that as crimes. They label them as problems. Because if right. you label it as a problem, then you handle the problem, versus a crime means that your, you know, commune is populated by criminals and you don't want to be labeled that way.
Crime even implies there's a person. Versus yes. a problem is like dehumanizing.
Yeah, it's really interesting the wording and language they end up using to kind of get around what they're doing. Or, you know, saying that we're handling the problem, but really you are torturing someone because they stole your food.
Right.
Ends up being kind of a thing that happens. I will say that not all party cadres were
right.
bad. I don't want it to seem like they were all horrible, because there are instances where cadres were keeping like dual sets of books. So you've got the one accounting book that you're sending right. to the state that says, oh, we had this much food. And then you've got the one that is actually how much you produced and what you kept
mm-hmm.
so that you can say like, oh, we produced, you know, X amount of grain, but we're going to say that we only produced, you know, this amount less so that we can, you know, survive and eat this amount that we actually produced.
Right.
And sometimes they were padding doing things like padding the grain levies with water so that they were, you know, fuller, looked fuller,
right.
You know, so they could retain more food for their constituents. In those cases, like, that's honestly how it should have functioned, how you would want those communes to be little communities that work together. And then when you have them all working well, then they raise the whole of the nation. Mm-hmm. But it ended up falling to the wayside, essentially, that most places did not do this.
Yeah, part of it is a system, then the other part is like human folly of
yes.
an ego
yeah.
that
well, even
kind of broke
the example of human folly. They had a thing during it. It sounds fine, and it should have been fine. The Four Pests campaign.
Yes.
And it was to destroy mosquitoes, rats, flies,
and
sparrows for some inexplicable reason. Now, the first three work.
Mm-hmm.
You eradicate the sparrows, and guess what?
Ecosystem collapse.
Exactly.
Yeah, that ended up being another one of those, you know, great ideas that then the execution of caused massive problems. So that's another, the Four Pests campaign is one of the things that is also cited as a frequent cause of the famine, because...
Yes.
You know, you cause a severe ecological imbalance by knocking out, you know,
right,
most of your bird population.
Because the sparrows would eat the locust.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So
and
now
then
suddenly.
No sparrows.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like in the U.S., we, because the U.S. was very into wolf hunting for a while, but then we realized that that overpopulates deer populations, and then the deer overeat the grasses and fauna, and then we have other problems down the line because of that.
Yes,
so
that
it's very similar.
Very much so, yeah.
Very much one of those things where a lot of the causes of this famine were generally unintended consequences of good ideas. And then the state failure to take action because they didn't want to say that those good ideas were actually bad.
Yeah, because no one wants to disavow Mao.
That's exactly
the thing.
You don't want to be seen as the one guy who's saying that Chairman Mao was wrong, because then you're, you know, essentially committing treason.
Right. So we were talking the start of the famine and the beginning of the middle part of what's going on. I guess... How do people pull through to get to Mao in the famine? Like, what, something had to change because China's still here.
There's not a lot of good, clear, you know, resolution here. It's why there's varying timelines of when the famine ended. You know, some scholars will say it was 61, some will say it was 62. Generally, you throw it in with the same timeline as the Great Leap Forward, which was 58 to 62, because they basically go hand in hand. And it really kind of, in the end, the state does acknowledge some things and starts shifting some resources around, which if they had done that in the first place, the famine would not have lasted. Right. And most of the people who made it through, they made it through these methods of, like, eating, you know, unripe crops. There were some instances of cannibalism, but most of those people did not actually survive because they were eating rotten people. And unfortunately, if you eat rotten flesh, you're probably going to get sick and then you're going to die. And then there's
and so
no
the
actual...
nutrients are pretty bad from that too.
You know, realistically, if you're
how I know that.
if your neighbor is starving and then you eat your starving neighbor who has nothing left on his bones, you're not really getting much out of that, right?
And then what happens is you have this lull, and then Mao kicks off the Cultural Revolution in 1966, which didn't cause a famine but caused other issues too.
Yeah, you end up basically going, you know, well, we got to do something, and just kind of under the table shifting some resources around.
Yeah.
To be fair, also probably a little bit easier to come back after you've had like 15 to 55 million people die, because now you don't got to support those people.
Right. Well, yeah,
and,
yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said for the adage of survival of the fittest, you know, the people who were more capable of surviving those things make it through and then are more likely to be able to handle the redirection after the fact.
Yeah, I feel like some people say, you know, let nature take its course for a lot of things, and that... I mean, this could be an example of, well, nature took its course because of bad decisions where people, the amount of people balances. Because that is so many people. Like, I don't.
Right, I can't even picture my mind.
No, it's so many people that it's like an overwhelming number that your brain refuses to even think about.
Like, we're in Kenosha, where, you know, it's a city of 100,000-ish. And this is.
I couldn't picture 1 million, let alone 55.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a huge number that I couldn't even begin to process what that would look like.
Like, that is a sixth of the U.S. population.
It's huge. It's a huge number of people that have, you know, perished.
Potentially,
from this.
I should say potentially, because it's 15 to 55.
Yes, we don't know for sure the numbers.
And really, you know, we talk about the long terms of this. Well, in 1975 in Henan province, there were these dam failures.
Yeah.
That were, the dams were built during the Great Leap Forward, and during the typhoon, they all collapsed.
Yeah, because, you know, you're shifting everybody to go build these dams, build these new canals, and make all this work, but then they do shoddy work because you're not feeding them.
So that kind of gets me to, was there, we know food-wise, complete failure, but was there a success in the... like industrial portion of this? Because the dam failure, from what you said, that didn't work, but was there any success gain that came from it?
Sort of. I mean, I know Scott mentioned earlier, like the pig iron, you know, you end up making your iron production goes up, but it's not actually quality, so you have some positives, but then in the long run, that's not going to actually hold up. You know, it's like buying a $10 pair of shoes. It's not going to last the same as your $150 pair of shoes because you're not putting the actual resources into it.
And really, when the Cultural Revolution starts, I think Mao, one part of it is Mao's attempt to reconsolidate his power in some ways, because he sort of let this free speech thing get kind of out of hand with everyone complaining.
You let the free speech get out of hand, and then you also just came off of, you know, a four-year famine, and so many people are dying, and they're starting to question, is this guy actually doing any good for us? Well, then you've got to aggressively try to reconsolidate your power because, oh no, things are slipping. You know, he's only been in power at that point, the 66, for like 16-ish years, so it's not...
There must be something because about telling them bad news, because Chiang Kai-shek, I know this story is probably apocryphal, I heard it once, but he would, apparently, if you gave him bad news, he'd throw teapots at you. So guess what? People stop giving him bad news.
There's something to be said for that. I think it all falls into that same, you know, like, well, I don't want to be the guy who does that, so I'm going to instead, you know, sugarcoat everything. But then when you sugarcoat everything, eventually that's going to come to bite you.
And it wasn't until later that the West realized that China and the USSR weren't exactly good friends.
Yeah.
We always thought, the West always thought it was monolithic because they didn't really know what was the internal struggles that were going on. But Mao really had a bumpy relationship with Khrushchev, let's just say that much.
Yeah, they were not friends.
No, and then part of this was to say, you know, because sometimes they would call these fields where all this grain would spring up, which were sort of fake because they would replant things, these Sputnik launches. And I thought, what a great phrase, because that's what the Soviet Union used to say, look, we launched a Sputnik. The West didn't do that. And so you're sort of battling for hearts and minds.
It all kind of goes into this kind of like propagandizing.
Yes.
You know, how can I make it look like what we're doing is actually good, even if it's not actually what we say it is?
Right.
You know, and I feel like that is what the bulk of the whole famine and its impacts end up being, is trying to make things look better than they are. And then, you know, you're basically shoveling dirt over your mistakes and saying like that's not actually happening.
Quite literally.
It's under the quite literally, you know.
It's almost like keeping troop morale up despite what the reality is.
Yeah.
So I do want to touch on this Cultural Revolution. Scott, you mentioned that like it was kind of a failure as well, or no?
I know that it was launched. I don't know much more about it. I mean, but it wasn't agriculturally. It was more along the lines of changing the culture.
And, yeah, it was more societal and social.
Okay.
Right.
But not that it wasn't that great either. It seems. It sounds like, at least.
I would say pretty much anything, you know, pre kind of like 1990 was not that great.
Oh, geez. Oh, boy.
Because you got to remember that at the tail end, I think the Cultural Revolution went to 1976, if I'm not mistaken. But in that time, China opened up to the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they did have some successes, you know, obviously. Right. They were able to open up trade and start making some, you know, actual having, like, political conversations and allies and those sorts of things. But at the same time, how much of that is because you're obfuscating what's actually going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, and I'm sure, because, I mean, this whole thing is, Cold War kind of period, right?
Yes,
and so. I mean, communication between nations is a little tense.
A wee bit.
I imagine that with the famine and Cold War, they're trying to figure out something with other nations, despite all that tenseness and relationships with communism from different nations.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, right around this period after, not during the famine, but, you know, in those kind of 20 or so years after, you've got issues with Taiwan and Vietnam and basically China trying to actually figure out where its place in the world is and trying to spread its fingers, but then having issues doing that.
Right. And even you can see this even earlier in the Korean War. Stalin sort of gave the North Koreans the green light, but then the Chinese got involved too, of course, because we got close to the Yellow River. But it was like, we're trying to show ourselves, you know, we're trying to, that kind of thing too. So, but it's interesting that, you know, we look at China today and it's much different. And I think in the United States for a long time, it was well, if we, you know, if we encourage them to become capitalist, then democracy will follow in its wake. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing followed. One thing happened.
But
quasi-capitalism, I guess. But it's still a state-run.
Right. You know, the CCP is still in power.
Yes. Yeah. And they still own businesses that run all this stuff.
But you're like, is that actually, you know, you say that you're the Chinese Communist Party, but are you actually communist?
Exactly. There's a lot of confusion.
Really, you know, but at the same time, you don't want to go saying that, oh, but we're not that anymore, because then what's with Mao's portrait on the Forbidden City?
Right. Yeah, it's still...
I've been to. I have pictures of the ginormous Mao.
It's still kind of that idea that you can't make your rulers or leaders, they can't be wrong.
Right.
Like, at all, even historically.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at all sorts of nations, and you don't want to say that your king is incorrect. You don't want to say that... Even it's a little bit different nowadays, because I think people are very willing to criticize politicians now.
Yeah, well, but we're in the U.S., so yes.
In the U.S., we are very, very willing to criticize everyone, I suppose. But there's a lot of places that they don't want to be the one saying that your leader is wrong, because if your leader is wrong, then your whole nation is going to fall apart.
And really, with a lot of these, that's where you get the term cult of personality.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. I think that... frequent examples of cult of personality are people like Mao and Stalin. And,
yes.
You know, those are, they're labeled that way for a reason.
Yeah.
And everyone was very pro Mao and behind Mao. And if you criticized him, you were the problem. And that's why so much of this ends up going way out of proportion, because if I say that there's no food here, then that means that I'm saying that Mao is greatly forward failed, and then if I do that, I'm saying that Mao failed, and then, oh my God,
the
I'm
state
gonna,
failed.
Yeah, the state failed, so then what are we even doing here? And, you know, it's like, well, maybe we should have just let the monarchy, the emperor, stay in power, but, you know.
Interesting.
Qing failed in 1912, so it was a very long, drawn out.
Right, because you had Sun Yat-sen.
Yes.
And after that, and there was, but then you had all these warring factions.
Yes.
That were...
And then finally someone comes out on top, and then, oh no, they're not actually doing everything that we hoped they would. But I don't want to criticize that, because if I do, then what was all of our effort for?
Well, King Louis XIV once said, the state is me.
Mm.
Or I am the state. I won't date the French, because I'm not really good with French, as we well know from this show.
Oh, yes. I've specifically let Elliot do all the pronunciation today. So, and how'd that work out for him?
Well,
a 14. The Sun King.
Ah, yes. Okay. I was about to be like, well, I mean,
not
does
the,
he still have a head?
Cake
yes.
Stuff.
Not
16.
He kept his head.
Okay.
But there was definitely unrest.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was starting even then, but that's a whole different.
Wait, that's a whole nother topic. Whole nother country. Whole nother time period.
Yeah. You know, speaking of other topics, Elliot.
Yes.
Thank you so much
for
coming
good.
Onto this. As we, you know, we sometimes we have Scott. It will be like, well, some experts will say, well, today we had an expert in a topic today. And thank you so much for coming in with this topic and coming into coming on the show. It's been great having you.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
I also echo those sentiments, and would like to have you back at some point. We'll talk more Chinese history.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So. I know the show's been a little long for our regular listeners, but we have to know, Scott, where are we going to go cruise through next time?
Well, Xander, it won't be China, but I'm going to ask the question, was Moby Dick based on a true story?
Oh, and I've tried reading Moby Dick, so I'm hoping that you can enlighten me, and we'll see that next time.
Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.